Right. Yeah. Thank you, Sam. Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk here. It's my first time at Perimeter, and I'm quite deeply impressed. So I will talk to you about a sort of new type of analog that we've found recently. It's an optical analog in 1+1 dimensions, and when we talk about maybe what's the usefulness of analogs, this I think would be useful because the analogy goes both ways, and we sort of find new physics of solitons that maybe have not been investigated before coming from this analogy. So it's an analogy coming from black holes that helps maybe understand some of the more mundane physics in the lab. But of course, there's aspects which go both ways. So the work is a collaboration within the QCMFP project between the University of St. Andrews and King's College London. These outer ones are two postdocs, experimental postdocs on the project. Chris is in the audience. He has done most of the work of this presentation. And the collaboration with King's College London is with Ruth, Sam, and Theo. And that has been very helpful, as you will see. So I'll start this talk by giving you a brief sort of more motivation of an introduction to ringdown and black hole oscillations, and then how we can actually connect ringdown and quasi-normal modes, and how a black hole is, what are the quasi-normal modes of a black hole. And then we switch to the analog and we talk about the quasi-normal modes in these optical solitons, and then we compare the two, the soliton and the black hole analogy. We have some simulations in the end, and then I will finish with summary and outlook. I have to remember to use this hockey stick. Many systems display a ring down in physics. So the archetypical system is, say, church bells. You hit the church bell and then it rings for a while. It dissipates energy to the outside world, and it has a characteristic sound that it produces by that. But it's not just church bells which exhibit this. So you have stringed instruments, electrical circuits. In optics, leaky cavities have been described by that. Water wave experiments have been done, and black holes also have a ring down. And so on the right-hand side, you see an example here of an acoustic resonator where you see that when you blow over this cavity, there's an acoustic ring down. So an oscillation which has a clearly defined frequency and a slow decay. And these frequencies are characteristic of the system that is ringing down. So these frequencies, for example, have also been observed in this water wave experiment recently from the Nottingham group. So if we talk about the ring down of black holes, then this can be understood as a perturbation of a black hole. That perturbation, so if we, for example, talk about Schwarzschild, but other black holes for other asymptotic curvatures display also these oscillations. They can be scalar, electromagnetic, or gravitational oscillations. And generally speaking, we have a field that is near the light ring, and that field couples to infinity as well as infalling couples towards the event horizon. So it's a decay from near the light ring in sort of both radial directions. And because these are propagating waves, they have a characteristic frequency and this characteristic decay, and those together are a characteristic of the black hole, so you can characterize the angular momentum and the mass of the black hole simply by looking at the ring down of the black hole. Okay, so in practice, this actually has been observed with the LIGO collaboration. So they have put up a detector here to record a signal, a bit more fancy, I suppose, than is displayed here. The signal that they have actually observed is displayed down here. So there was a black hole merger, two black holes spiraling into each other first, which produces a sort of slow frequency, and then they merged. So there's a transient of this gravitational wave signal while they merged, and in the end, out of these two black holes forms one black hole, but it's a perturbed black hole, and this perturbed black hole relaxes by a ring down, which you see here again, as we've seen similarly, with a decaying amplitude and a characteristic frequency. Okay, so that's our introduction to these black hole oscillations, and what we want, what I want to present you in this talk is sort of an analogy that we make up in optics with this. But we will go a bit more into detail now to look at what are these quasi-normal modes, what are the ring downs, and how they are actually connected to each other. Okay, so so everybody is familiar with normal modes, I suppose, and they are displayed here on the left-hand side. So these are oscillations of some harmonic oscillator, and they are systems that do not lose energy. They are conservative systems described by some Hermitian Hamiltonian, and they just oscillate forever with a characteristic frequency. And on the right-hand side, you see then quasi-normal modes. So these are oscillations that are systems that are not closed or not conservative. They are open system. They can couple to the outside world. And these systems, therefore, are characterized by a decay as well as an oscillation. And the decay and the oscillation together, you can see as a complex frequency. So that's our complex frequency here. And example systems of that are plasmonic resonators, fluid vortices, black holes, and what I want to tell you in this talk, optical solitons as well. Okay, so that's quasi-normal modes, but we can also extend that to, in particular, quasi-normal modes of fields. So if we have a field oscillating, there is two types of systems. They have to be localized systems, so the system has to be able to retain to some degree that energy that is radiated away. So that is localized in space, and that localization can come from something like a time-independent potential, for example, or it comes from some sharply defined boundary conditions, like what we would have in a resonator or in a cavity. And then here we have some display of how these oscillations look like. So this is across space, and then in time you see how the amplitude in time at any point decays. And if you look at this little inset here, then it looks like as if something would be moving to the right. And that just means that if you have something that is decaying in time and it's an oscillatory wave towards the outside, far away from this localized region, then the behavior in space has to be the opposite of time because of this sort of wave behavior. Therefore, when we have something that decays in time, it actually has to blow up in space. And therefore, these oscillatory solutions are unphysical solutions. They have an infinite amplitude, and so one would naturally ask, why are they actually important if they are unphysical? But as you've seen in the LIGO experiment, in a ring down of a system, you will see a transient period of time in which the system follows these unphysical mode solutions in a limited region of space, so there's no divergence in that case. Okay, so now the question is, how do these quasi-normal modes actually appear in a ring down? And we can understand this from this slide. So we start off with some form of wave equation describing the wave around a localized potential. And we have some initial conditions there. And this type of system can be solved with a Green's function approach. So we can readily write down the solution as this integral over all frequencies over the single frequency Green's function solution, where G is the Green's function and J is where our initial data enters into that solution. So the initial condition, essentially. This is an integral over all frequencies from minus infinity to plus infinity, and you evaluate this integral as a contour integral in the complex plane of frequencies. And in this contour integral, you have to, the integral is dominated, or the integral is results from the resonances in the Green's function. So that gives you your residues. So that integral over frequency turns into a sum over the residues, and each pole in the Green's function gives you a complex frequency at which this system can oscillate. And then the spatial extent is called the quasi-normal mode wave function. And so the general solution is written as a superposition of these quasi-normal modes plus some small rest term which appears at the late time stage of the relaxation. So a typical system, a typical signal looks like this. So we have some initial perturbation of our signal, of our system, that is not periodic and depends really on how we perturb the signal. And then we have a very regular ring down period, which is described by this sum. And the more modes you include in this sum, the more precise you get this ring down. And then there is eventually a late time tail period in the end. Yep.
Hi, I'm sorry, could I very just quickly ask, is your decay in here frequency independent?
Sorry, which decay?
A in your exponential, the A plus I omega? It seems like you're integrating over the frequency, but not the decay. Why is that the case?
This omega is complex, or...
Why is the A there?
Oh, the A, okay. The A is just this A is to have the contour not hitting this branch cut. So you lift the contour slightly, and then you put A to zero. A is just a small offset. The quasi-normal modes show up in the ring down because of these poles in the Green's function. And so they characterize the potential. Okay, so now you might ask the question, okay, I have a black hole and it oscillates. Why is it actually that the modes actually can leave the black hole, because the black hole would be attractive, gravitationally attractive, and this is explained on this slide. So if you have a field that is, or a particle or what, that is coming towards the black hole, then in the radial coordinate, it actually approaches the black hole and then leaves again. And this trajectory here is a trajectory that can be described by a repulsive potential of the black hole, and it's basically the radial potential. So if we have a massless scalar field, then the solution of that field equation is given by an equation that can be factorized into spherical harmonic part and a radial wave function part, and the radial wave function then fulfills obviously a one-dimensional equation, which takes the form of the Schrödinger equation, where we also introduce this tortoise coordinate. So here this potential is as this bell shape if we go to tortoise coordinates, which means that the event horizon is at the tortoise coordinate being at minus infinity. So we basically we image the radius from the event horizon to infinity onto minus infinity to plus infinity with this coordinate. And then we get, for a Schwarzschild black hole, we get an effective gravitational potential, which is given by this formula. And if you look at that formula, you see that it's a repulsive potential which peaks at approximately the light ring. And then we introduce here the tortoise coordinate. So now the coordinate goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. And here you see that the potential looks a bit more bell-shaped. And so there, then the quasi-normal modes of these potentials here depend just on that shape of the potential. The ring down, however, is dominated by the quasi-normal modes that are sort of longest lived, and these are the lowest order quasi-normal modes in that sum that was the lowest decaying quasi-normal modes are the ones that decay the slowest, and therefore they dominate the decay. it has been shown in this paper by Machoon that the lowest order mode is actually dominated by the central part of this potential. So the ring down is dominated by essentially the height and the curvature of the potential. And that motivated to exchange this complicated potential with a simpler potential, for which that scattering problem or the quasi-normal modes are analytically known. And one example of that is the so-called Peschel-Teller potential, and that was also historically the first one that was used in this context. So we have a 1 over hyperbolic cosine square, or a hyperbolic secant square shaped potential with which we approximate the real gravitational potential of various types of black holes. And it gives us a spectrum that is a good approximation when we keep n small. So that approximation allows us to calculate that spectrum that you see here again. Here you see the spectrum in the complex plane. So this is the real part of the frequency and the minus the imaginary part of the frequency. So you get a series of solutions of frequencies here of constant real part and ever-increasing imaginary parts. So the decay for the higher order modes here is going faster and faster. And you can model with this spectrum, you can model various black holes, so the Schwarzschild black hole in De Sitter, anti-De Sitter. And if you look at the Nariae black hole, which is a slightly artificial thing, is sort of the maximum, the largest De Sitter Schwarzschild black hole. But it turns out that in the Nariae black hole, the partial Teller potential, or this second square potential, actually is not approximate, but it's precise. It's exact, I want to say. Okay, so here we see the time evolution. So the lowest order decays the slowest, and then with higher orders, the decay is speeding up. So those are black hole quasi-normal modes. And now the question is, what can we do with this in optics? In our research group, we deal with optical pulses and optical fibers, short pulses and optical fibers. And so they are, they have this shape, and there's a typical solution of these pulses which has a hyperbolic secant shape. And that was the idea, initially the fundamental idea, whether we could use these pulses as potentials. So if you have light in an optical fiber, then the light experiences, the light follows, obeys the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, so the evolution of the field is governed by two terms. This term here, which describes the dispersion of the medium and different velocities or for different frequencies, and the other term describes the nonlinearity. So the nonlinearity in the fiber is a third order nonlinearity, or is described by what we call the optical carry effect. So the refractive index of that fiber is slightly larger when we have an intensity of the pulse. And this increase of the refractive index is essentially instantaneous. So we have then a specific solution to this nonlinear Schrödinger equation, where these two terms here cancel each other exactly, and and therefore the change of the envelope of that field A is zero, and that solution is called the soliton, or the soliton solution, or you could say the fundamental soliton solution, and that has an envelope that has a hyperbolic secant shape, and so the intensity of that is hyperbolic secant squared as it propagates through the fiber, and it's a constant constant pulse shape. So it doesn't evolve. There's an overall phase change, but the amplitude or the instantaneous intensity which creates a refractive index doesn't change. And so the idea is now, if we have that pulse and we have some other light around that pulse, then let's assume that other light has a rather different frequency, so we can clearly distinguish between the two. And that other light could be a little bit faster than the pulse. So it would come from here, and it would be, if it's on the other side, it would also run away from that pulse. But under the pulse, because of the higher refractive index under the pulse, this light might be slowed, so we have light that would converge towards this interface here, or diverge from that interface. So there are classical turning points. If you come in here, you can't cross this line, and that's displayed here. So what happens is, this is the frame of the soliton. Green is the intensity of the soliton as we propagate along the fiber, and the ray of light is coming in, and it encounters this turning point, so it turns around, and everything is moving along the fiber in the frame of the soliton. Everything comes out the other end of the fiber, but the light that is coming in changes from being faster than the soliton initially to being slower than the soliton. What you also see in this plot is that the fiber lengths here acts as some form of effective time coordinate. So you could say that this is the equivalent of a space-time diagram. So the length of the fiber takes the role of time. So in these systems that we have, there's always an exchange between space and time. So when we talk about this as an analog, then our analog time is the length of the fiber.
Thank you. Is the light incoming blue shifted or red shifted?
The light
does
incoming.
Does it change the frequency or not?
The light incoming can have any frequency as long as that frequency means that the light is approaching the soliton. And then what actually happens that is indicated here with these colors is that as it approaches the soliton, it sees a change in refractive index, and that change in refractive index modulates the phase of the incoming light, and modulating the phase of the incoming light changes the frequency of the incoming light, and because the phase speeds up, in this case, the light is blue shifted, and then once the light is blue shifted, it loses velocity because of dispersion. Okay, you could have also a speed up depending on how your dispersion is, but in this case we have chosen a dispersion such that the light is slowed down when it becomes bluer, and then it eventually leaves the soliton.
Yeah, thank you. Yep.
Okay, so So now we say, okay, so this is our system. Now we want to model this light ray interacting with the soliton. And so we take our nonlinear Schrödinger equation from the slide before, and we make a perturbative approach to it. So we have some low intensity field that has an intensity much smaller than that of the soliton. And we interact, so we put that as an ansatz and go to sort of the linear order. So what you see is you get these terms, and there's one term here that is fast oscillating. So if your probe frequency is different from the soliton frequency, which is the scenario that we want, then this term here is a fast oscillating term and just averages away. So we neglect that. Then the next approximation that we do here is that we say the probe is really not very broadband. It's covering some frequency band, but it is enough to terminate the dispersion here at the second order, which is a good description even for the soliton. So it allows us to describe the probe as a pulse, but not of excessive bandwidth. And then the most important assumption here is that we say we want the probe at a point where the probe can propagate with the pulse. Because if this is a quasi-normal mode system, the probe should be able to sit on the pulse and slowly dissipate away, radiate away from the soliton. So we choose a frequency of the pulse, which is of the probe, which is approximately such that the two fields move with the same speed. Okay, so that leaves us with a perturbation equation of this form here. So we see that this term here turns into that, and so we have a potential term here like similar to the Schrödinger equation, so that the probe experiences a potential. So this is written more explicitly in the form of a Schrödinger equation, and with this ansatz here, we eliminate the time dependence of that equation. So this is, if you want, the mode equation for the quasi-normal mode in this particular fiber optical soliton. You can solve this mode equation, bringing this differential equation that in some coordinates it takes a hypergeometric form, and then the solution is given by the hypergeometric function. But in fact, the solution can be written in terms of these four terms that are multiplied with each other, and that's quite instructive to look at. So we have a first term here of the mode solution, which describes the divergence in space. Tau is now our spatial coordinate, so the solution blows up in tau. So that's what we were expecting. Then we have a second term, which describes the decay in time. So that goes with the imaginary part of our mode frequency. So the decay in time is captured by the second one. Then the third one describes the phase velocity of the mode. And I get back to that in a moment. But it doesn't have a bearing on the intensity of that mode. And the last one is this hypergeometric function, but because we have a mode index n, this hypergeometric function as its first argument has minus n, which means that this hypergeometric function is just a polynom of order n. And so essentially what this fourth term is doing, it's controlling the parity of these solutions. So you have a polynom of order n in tau, or in hyperbolic tangent tau, which means the symmetry of the solutions is alternating between odd and even.
8 minutes, Frieda.
8 minutes, okay. Okay, so we can also calculate the frequencies of these quasi-normal modes. And even though this expression here looks a bit complicated, you notice that it's just depending on the ratio of these parameters. This is the group velocity dispersion at the soliton frequency is beta S2, and beta A2 is the group velocity dispersion at the probe. So the ratio of group velocity dispersions is the one parameter that controls the spectrum. And so if we plot that in the complex plane, then you see the solutions are no longer like what we had in the black hole. They are no longer vertical. They lie on these parabolas. And there is two types of solutions, curiously. There is some that have an outgoing phase velocity and others that have an ingoing phase velocity. In fact, there is a finite number of solutions that have an outgoing phase velocity, and then there is an infinite number of solutions that have an ingoing phase velocity. So these modes are unphysical, but we can still plot unphysical solutions. And so this is the fundamental mode, the first order, second order mode. What you see is that in space, tau, there's a divergence here, and the divergence becomes worse with higher order of these modes. And there is a decay in time zeta, and also the decay in time zeta becomes faster with higher orders. And then in color, you see the phase profile of these modes. So you see here, the phase is moving outwards to plus minus tau, and that velocity becomes smaller and smaller as we go to higher order modes. If we then go even further into these ingoing phase velocities, you see that the phase velocity from going outwards turns to be going inwards. So we have a change of phase velocity for these. But otherwise, the trend continues to be more divergent and faster decaying in these modes. Okay, now back to the analogy. So these are the two describing equations, mode equations. So we have the soliton mode equation given by those fiber parameters here, and the hyperbolic secant potential, and the black hole quasi-normal modes. This approximation with a partial Teller potential is then described also by the hyperbolic secant potential. So they are identical mode equations. And so we have two modes which have identical spatial profiles, and so identical field expansions. But if you look closely, then the frequency of this here enters linear and here quadratic. So they are related in their frequencies with this relation. So the quasi-normal mode frequencies of one system and the other system, they are related like this. So they have different mode frequencies, and therefore the temporal behavior of these modes, of this analog, is different, and they have different field evolutions. So we cannot fully see the whole dynamics, but we can see the identical spatial profiles of these. However, we can tune the parameters of our soliton quasi-normal mode by going to what we call the dispersionless limit. So if you reduce the group velocity dispersion at the probe, then the expression for the quasi-normal mode simplifies to this expression here, which then is really analogous to the quasi-normal modes of the black hole. So I've depicted this here, so you see the black hole spectrum in blue and the quasi-normal mode of the soliton in red. And if you tune the dispersion to being less and less dispersive, these two modes align more and more. So, and if we assume that the ring down is characterized by the lowest, is dominated by the lowest order modes, we can get a good approximation even of the concrete spectrum of these modes. So now I'm going to show you a simulation of this. So we have a hyperbolic secant potential here, and we have some probe light that comes in and scatters at this potential. And we look at the top of this potential and see what's going to happen. So at the top of this potential, as the probe comes in, the field starts to increase and oscillates. That's going up and down. This is a log scale. So the field increases, and then it relaxes by this characteristic ring down that we've seen before. And it's also characterized by a Lorentzian profile. If you analyze it, you can show that our analytic description of these this ring down and the evaluation of this numerical simulation, they agree very well, and they agree also roughly to the WKB approximation. Agree? Okay, so yeah, I'm basically done. So what we've also shown here is that we have, if we propagate not just the probe and have the soliton, the probe scattered on a hyperbolic secant potential, in this simulation we have propagated the soliton as well. So all the waves are propagated according to the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. And in this situation, there is a little bit of back action of the probe onto the soliton. And what we see is that these phase contours here of the ring down that you see also here, that does survive the back action, the weak back action of the probe. So it's a robust system. And so that's just a preliminary first result of these more realistic simulations, which can show us the full dynamics of the optical analog. Okay, so I'm coming to the summary and outlook. So we have seen that we can use the soliton as an optical potential, and the hyperbolic secant squared potential is quite nice because it is very much related to those potentials, effective potentials for black holes, for modeling that. But in fact, you can create arbitrary potential shapes in the fiber. You only have to be careful that they are typically not time independent. So you have to find very specific solutions to the nonlinear Schrödinger equation so that they are time independent. And then for the solitons, we have the ring down described by these quasi-normal modes. And this is a new experimentally accessible black hole analog system. It's the first soliton quasi-normal mode system, because in optics, the only systems that are out there that are described by quasi-normal modes are resonators or cavities, which are obviously stationary systems. So this is the first sort of moving, propagating quasi-normal mode system. And so The next things to do is obviously to observe these ring downs experimentally. So we have built an apparatus in the lab where we have a probe and a soliton. So we set up a soliton and the probe. And when we're getting into the hot phase of observing these signals, it's complicated because in the fiber, you can't really cut off the fiber from the end. Our time coordinate is the length along the fiber. And if you want to observe something in time, in principle, you need to cut the fiber. But these fibers, they cost about £1 per millimeter. So if you cut a centimeter, that's 10 pounds. And so if meters of fibers are involved here, it's quite expensive. So what we have to do is we have to carefully delay the probe and soliton interaction in the fiber and also manage the chirps of these pulses so that they collide with the correct widths. So that's a little bit fiddly, but I think we've overcome most of that problem. So then the next things also we could do is generalizations beyond group velocity matched quasi-normal modes. The group velocity matching condition is only good for the analog, but you can go away from that and just see what the quasi-normal mode spectra, how they look like if you go away from that. And we could look at other solitons like quarter-vector free solitons or Sine-Gordon and see what their quasi-normal modes are. And then obviously we're interested in quantum effects connected to these quasi-normal modes, like the interaction of these two quantum fields, the soliton as a quantum field and the probe as a quantum field. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Frieder, for a very interesting talk. Any questions?
Thanks. Thanks for the talk. At the end, you mentioned that one might want to reduce dispersion to have something closer to the real black hole, but how do you plan to do that? And also, isn't it a problem because dispersion and nonlinearity is the source of your soliton?
Okay, good question, yeah. So how can we reduce the dispersion? So at the moment we have said, okay, the soliton is set up at some frequency and it generates this potential, and the probe is at some other frequency. And this other frequency, the only requirement that we have there is that it propagates at the same group velocity as the soliton. Okay, so the soliton dispersion we don't change. We just have it as a soliton, and we try to have another frequency that moves at the same speed with the soliton, but with much lower dispersion at that point. And that that is a tricky business, but I can imagine that you can find a parameter or how to design a fiber that has this property.
I see, thanks.
It was a really wonderful talk, thank you. I remember many years ago when we started discussing about this, you mentioned that perhaps this could naturally appear in these optical fibers if the pulse is not of the right shape and you couple it in, maybe then it would relax into the right shape by giving off this ring down mode. What do you think? I mean, this is different now. This is a controlled excitation or of the ring down modes, but what about sending a wrong pulse and see if it would relax through this emission of the ring down modes?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Yeah, it was indeed, I think when we were discussing, the first idea was to have that. But the fact is that the soliton is a stable solution to propagation in the fiber. So if you experimentally, you're not putting in quite the right power or quite the right shape or so, it actually rather quickly turns into a proper soliton and the rest of energy is dissipated as a dispersive wave. And the initial idea was that, one of the ideas was that this would lead to an effective oscillation of the soliton, but it doesn't scale exponentially, that decay. It scales like, I think, 1/(√ fiber length or something. We were looking that up. So the soliton perturbation theory is well studied, obviously, also, but it doesn't have this this quasi-normal mode decay. So it's a, I'm not exactly sure how that comes about, and in fact, even the books don't give an argument why it is sort of basically 1 over square root of time decay, but it's not an exponential decay in there. Maybe that has to do with that the that there is a, still a significant nonlinear interaction between the soliton, so that the wave is sort of leaving the soliton and getting back into, and leaving and getting back into while it's forming the eventual soliton.
Here. So yeah, thank you very much. I was wondering about this back action, and if you increase the power more and more of this wave you scatter in, you can go to the regime where actually you scatter solitons from solitons. So there should be just scattering without kind of distortion. And how is there a connection? Can you do a connection in this direction? And then go further if the soliton is too strong, then actually something else happens. So I was just wondering how you connect this with soliton collisions.
Okay, so I should say that the probe is in a dispersion regime which doesn't allow for solitons.
Ah, okay.
I mean, not by principle, but in our practical case. So if you increase the probe intensity, the main thing that is interacting with the soliton is that the probe reflects part of the soliton, and it's frequency shifted, but the average momentum in the fiber is a conserved quantity. So the nonlinear Schrödinger equation has that conserved quantity.
Okay.
So what will happen is that the soliton gets a kick.
Mm-hmm.
It gets a kick and goes to some slightly different frequency and reforms there. That's the first thing that would happen. And then I suppose that if you put much more energy into the probe, you will actually eventually destroy the soliton.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so let's thank Frieder again.